the most extraordinary things that we have achieved here is a negotiated solution to what was a bloody conflict. And I think maybe that's what the world could learn from South Africa. I've seen in the past 5 years institutions and just people learning how to go into situations of conflict and negotiate to a place where you can have two winners. And I think if the world can learn that lesson from us, that's something pretty special that we can give.
This is the second in our two-part look at the new South Africa on today's edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. In the weeks leading up to the April elections in South Africa, there was intense violence in some places, especially between supporters of the Inkatha Freedom Party, the IFP, and the African National Congress, the ANC. Sometimes entire towns were affected. The fighting would cause death and destruction, leading thousands of others to flee their homes in search of safety. But now, just weeks after the elections, there are signs of hope.
These houses were actually destroyed during the height of violence, and then people left their houses, as you could actually see them. And then it used to be no-go zone area, but now, as I'm talking to these young people, they are saying that they are able to move freely, they are able to go and visit their friends. And then it is a very interesting development. So much excited about it.
This is the town of Ladysmith in the KwaZulu-Natal province. Mzome Mata is an organizing secretary for the South African Council of Churches here.
Before they left, it used to be families who, in fact, the composition of this township, it perhaps one have to quickly sketch the background. It was composed from the people who were uprooted from the land which used to be their original, and then they were brought here. As you could see, it is a very without substantial developments, but that again people were able to settle it. And during the time of violence, and then this is area which used to be the ANC IFP. Let me check. Linda, we in the area. This section, as we are, it used to be the ANC.
Okay.
Yes.
And on the other side of the road over here?
Yeah, and other side. Down, as you see, that pole down there,
yeah.
It used to be the IFP.
I see.
Yeah.
Now, these people here had to leave because?
Because they were attacked by the IFP.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And now they've moved into the squatter camps we saw as we passed by?
Yes. But now they have to come back, because that's why we are trying to develop a project, a reconstruction program. So they would have to come back. But at this point in time, they are not actually staying here. But few families who still have their houses have actually get back.
The houses look very bad. The violence was very serious.
Yeah, it was. Quite a number of people lost their lives, and a lot of families actually lost their beloved one. It was a very pathetic situation. And we did our level best to try to bring about peace on those parties which found themselves were conflicting.
What's been the situation since the elections?
Well, the environment seems to be quite a healthy one. You could see people's face bright. People are just walking. It's like people were deprived this golden opportunity.
The IFP is largely made up of members of the indigenous Zulu tribe, although many Zulus belong to other parties. The IFP leader, Chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi, is now in the cabinet, part of the Government of National Unity. But the IFP is a reluctant guest at this table. The armed violence between the groups has largely ended, but the tensions remain. IFP spokesman Ed Tillett reacted defensively to even the most general questions about IFP policy. I asked him to comment on recent stories that the Zulu king, Goodwill Zwelithini, has tried to distance himself from the IFP and Chief Buthelezi. Such a split would have a great impact on South African politics.
Let me just tell you right now. You know, if the people who claim that there's a split between the king and the chief really knew both those two men, they would never dare say such a thing. Because you must understand that the National Party government, they started this whole thing in the 1970s when the chief minister spurned their offer to opt for independence in the KwaZulu homeland. They started this whole thing of trying to drive a wedge between the chief minister and His Majesty the Zulu King. And they went to the extent of trying to involve the Zulu King in establishing a new political organization, which was basically a front for the National Party government, which they tried to set up in KwaZulu to contest KwaZulu elections. And fortunately, it was exposed before it could actually contest those elections. It was exposed as a state front. And the Zulu King also spurned their advances. But ever since that time, the National Party government have been trying to create this perception of a wedge between the king and the chief minister, and that they had a conflict of interest. And the ANC, for their own party political goals, have also perpetuated this whole theme. But there is no, in fact, if anything, I mean, firstly, the chief minister is the king's uncle. And if you go through his political history, everything he has done has been, if not to the king's blessing, it has been done in thorough consultation with the king, and in fact, often for the king. So, I mean, completely reject that.
Would it be good, though, for the king to be seen as more politically independent, maybe sort of above the fray? Would that be a good position for him to be in?
Well, we would argue that he is politically independent. He has never, ever occupied any party political platforms. It is so happened that his political philosophy has coincided with that of the IFP, and for that reason, the ANC have tarred him with the IFP brush and have tried to project him as being politically partisan. But that is not the case at all. I mean, when there are king's functions, for example, all Zulus, irrespective of political affiliation, are entitled to go there. And I mean, he is the king of all Zulus. All his subjects are important to him.
The IFP reservations notwithstanding, the spirit of reconciliation in South Africa is truly amazing. So many people are willing to set aside decades of injustices in the effort to create a new nation.
On the lawns of the Union Buildings the other day with the inauguration, I happened to be there, and you got the feeling that people are beginning to own South Africa.
This is Dr. Klippies Kritzinger. He's a professor at the University of South Africa.
The most emotional experience that day was not when any of the people said, "So help me God," but when the aeroplanes went over. And you could feel the people were saying, you know, they were waving their flags, and somebody turned around and shook my hand and said, "For the first time, this is our Air Force." You see, now that the shift of power that takes place in that process, owning, this is our police. I mean, maybe it's also just a euphoria. But they did it for that black President Mandela there, you see. They did it in honor of him. So, and he's in charge of all this hardware now, all the airplanes and all the tanks. And it's that sense of being in charge, of us being South Africans together, that gives me a tremendous sense of hope. I mean, black people still don't sing Die Stem. And I still can't find myself singing it, to be quite frank. I've refused to sing it for so many years, the Afrikaner anthem, that it'll take me quite a while to actually get it across my lips again because of what it symbolized, you know. But Mandela really told the people at the soccer stadium the other day, you must learn to the words of this and you must learn to sing it. We mustn't pay only lip service to national unity. And of course, he also said the whites who can't understand Zulu or Xhosa have to start learning these languages to sing Nkosi Sikelela as well. So, yes, Mandela perhaps as a person is our greatest figure of unity and hope. If only enough white people can really place their trust in him and not just grudgingly accept him as the black people's choice. But without him, we wouldn't have been able to make this transition personally, I think. Because he was reasonable enough, enough of a statesman, enough of a respectable person, of a non-avenging kind of figure, even after 27 years in jail, for whites to feel that, you know, there is something special here.
Narrowing the gap between the experiences of white South Africa and black South Africa is a key task, one often focused on by new President Nelson Mandela. He has gone out of his way to make whites feel comfortable, especially at official gatherings. As we just heard, because South Africa now has two national anthems, Mandela insists that both be sung. Nkosi Sikelela Afrika, which means God Bless Africa, the longtime underground song of the anti-apartheid movement, and the old Afrikaans anthem, Die Stem, which was despised by so many. Miriam Dekile, a retired teacher in Soweto, began bridging the worlds these two songs represent many years ago.
When the riot started in 1976, and the children were being molested by the soldiers who were Afrikaner-speaking people, and my little children were running away from them, saying they were going to kill them. Later on, I felt, at this moment now in time, there was a change. They were now coming over to the schools and waving to the children, sort of showing love to them. It is then that I said to myself, but let me take a closer look at the stem. What makes us so different? What makes us, you know, not come closer together with the Afrikaner people? What is this hatred about? Then I thought of the stem. And I read it, and when I read it, I found that it included me as someone who belongs to this country, because the people who were singing it were saying to themselves, this was their land, and I was saying, legitimately, this is my land. And for so many years, perhaps like them, have not looked at Nkosi Sikelela Afrika and seen in it that they are also included. And so we have drifted from one another. I started, in fact, loving the stem. I said, man, for so many years I've not seen the good that is in this thing which talks about me. Then I said to myself, my children were going to learn the stem. And I started teaching it to the whole school. And when I read the words, they were actually saying, Exalive, exalsterve, for ons land, South Africa, which means I will live and I'll die for my country, South Africa. Who else could say it better than myself? So that is why, from that time, the hatred that I had subsided, and I felt I really would reach out to these people with love to them, because they did not know that I am part of them. I am a sister to them and a brother to them, and I in turn did not know that they were a brother and a sister to me. We have been drifting apart from one another, and yet coming together, we are just one people, let alone the skin, but we are just one people. Because we have thought alike, we have thought of Nkosi Sikelela Afrika, they have thought of the stem, and the words definitely merge somewhere, and they bring us together.
This is the second in a two-part Common Ground look at life in the new South Africa. Transcripts and cassette tapes of this broadcast are available. Listen at the end of the program for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that encourages discussion of international affairs. What is the significance of this place? I mean, how do Afrikaners feel
when they see this place?
That differs very much. Personally, I see it as a place of remembrance of a piece of history. There's people who actually experience it very much like people experience a sanctuary or something. It's almost holy ground, that type of thing. And then there's people who would just bring their children here to see another place of interest in Pretoria. Mm-hmm. And among the Afrikaners, among tourists, I think it's just a tourist attraction.
This is Willem Boshoff. He's an Afrikaner and a lecturer at the University of South Africa. We're talking inside the Voor Trekker Monument in Pretoria. This huge memorial commemorates the Afrikaners' ability to conquer this land.
For me personally, it's very much part of a recent Afrikaner history. In recent times, a lot of conflict and so on went into this area because the right and left flanks of the Afrikaner Dom often wanted to use it simultaneously and couldn't. So there were a lot of conflict, but as a place, as a sign of the history, I think it's very important because of the sheer size of it, but also because a lot of intense emotions went into the initial history, the gathering of the money for the place and so on, because that was in the 30s, built in the 30s when Afrikaner Dom especially was very, very poor. So it was done by 1 and 2 cents and pennies and so on.
Now, if we look up, you know, several hundred feet, there's the spot there where, this tiny spot where the sun can come in. Tell us about that.
Right. On the 16th of December, one of the very important dates in Afrikaner history, because that's the day of the covenant, the sun ray falls through that little hole onto a cenotaph, which is...
A cenotaph?
Yeah, that's a symbolic grave, a huge stone on the floor of the whole monument, and there stands written, "We for the South Africa," which is part of the previous anthem of South Africa, very much Afrikaner type of song. And on that day, there's always a religious gathering here, and when at 12 o'clock the sun, the ray of sunlight falls on that, there's normally kept a minute of silence. And the commemoration of hundreds of people who died in that piece of history is done.
I know in recent history, recent world history, we've seen monuments and statues being pulled down all over the place from Lenin. And in Romania, we saw lots of statues torn down. The Berlin Wall came down. What about the Voor Trekker Monument?
Yeah, we are interested in what's going on. We are not sure. On the one hand, on the other hand, there's a lot of goodwill among the peoples of South Africa after a successful and good transition of power. We do not expect something like that. On bad nights, you might fear about something like that. But in fact, I'm not very afraid of a monument like this being pulled down. I believe that a lot of statues will go down. I think they will be resettled, given back to communities or something, but taken out of the centers of cities. I think historical names will be changed and so on, but I think that's part of the transition in Africa. That was part of everything happening north of us, and we are not going to miss out on that one.
What do you think about the sort of the far right wing of the Afrikaners? I mean, are they a serious threat to national security?
I'm not sure. I don't think so. But they have done a few serious things. I hope that they come to their senses. I believe that very many of them have almost religious convictions for doing that, and that makes me afraid, because I think that's a very powerful type of motive for doing such things. But I think that a lot will depend on what is happening in South Africa. Personally, I see a specific political possibility for the Afrikaners as one of the ways in which that drive can be quenched. But until that happens, I hope they come to their senses and become part of a more sensible solution to what's happening in South Africa, and not trying to break up the party, because it's internationally acknowledged. The new government was welcomed by almost everybody on earth, and there's no way in which 200,000 or 100,000 or 10,000 people are going to derail this train.
Albie Sachs expressed it like this: we have the right to be one nation, and we have the right to be different. And it's how to marry those two concerns. This, in big terms, unity and diversity. But it's not an abstract game of unity and diversity. It's a, we need little concrete projects that will help people to feel at home, that there's enough religious space, cultural space around them, that they don't feel they're being pushed into a corner, or they're being, their culture or their faith is being destroyed. And yet at the same time, not make that a launching pad for racism all over again, or for separatism. And I don't think there's any recipe. We'll have to try and find a way and experiment.
This again is Dr. Klippies Kritzinger.
We battle with this transition of how to not scare whites out of their wits and yet not allow them to be racist any longer. And we will just have to see whether we can make it. If we can't make it, it's back to war, as it seems to me. Back to real acrimony. We're living in the honeymoon feeling of a new South Africa. And that's, of course, dangerous.
Perhaps the most significant social movement in South Africa, beyond ending apartheid, has been a massive human rights education program. The program has raised awareness of basic human rights among South Africans of all race, age, gender, and economic groups. Patrick Kelly is from a monitoring group called the Human Rights Committee.
The struggle against apartheid has basically been a struggle for human rights. I mean, it's been a struggle for people to exercise the most basic of human rights, that to vote, and that to have free political activity. So many of the campaigns that the ANC embarked on, and that sort of liberation movements, if we can call them that, to sort of put them all in one cluster, embarked upon were human rights struggles. So many people are familiar, I'm sure, with the Freedom Charter in the 1950s, in which quite a concerted campaign of consultation went about, and there was a system of volunteers who went from door to door in many, many places around the country asking people what their primary concerns were. And one can see, you know, many of the basic things that people needed and that people wanted coming through in the Freedom Charter. So I think that there is that sort of culture of human rights. It hasn't necessarily been in a sophisticated manner, in the sense of that township activists would be able to tell you what the different clauses of the UN Declaration of Human Rights are. And I think on that level, human rights education still needs to continue.
Echoing these views is Jenny Detali. She's national president of the Black Sash. Black Sash was begun by a group of white women in 1955 as an outspoken critic of racist legislation. Members wearing black sashes have been seen protesting outside of government buildings for decades in South Africa. The group's work now includes a wide variety of human rights issues, and they operate a network of voluntary advice offices across the country to help any South African trying to deal with government agencies. I asked Ms. Detali if the new government means an end to the work of the Black Sash.
Oh, if only the job were done. I've been dying to go grow roses, but there's an awful lot of work to do. South Africa is trying at this stage to democratize. And as you know, democracy doesn't come quickly and easily. We've taken the first giant step of an all-inclusive vote, but now we have to make sure that democratization process happens throughout the country. We just think there's more to do than we ever had before, because at last we have the opportunities. We have the opportunities to make something work. And we're actually very excited about it. But as you know, every nation has to be vigilant all the time, especially on the issues of human rights. We can't transform this place overnight, but I think that we're going to try.
We've seen such success here in human rights, but there are people living in very rural, remote areas. There are people living in squatter settlements. How do you go about educating them about the human rights that have been won?
I think it's going to have to be a process which a number of organizations will do in networks. We're very keen on networks here. And I think that we will have to look. We started with the first bit of human rights education, and that was education for democracy, for the vote. That was a very, very exciting process, because people would first of all come and say, oh, what's this going to get me? And then you talk through the whole issue of what a vote actually can mean. And I must admit that some of my most rewarding days in this organization have been in those interactions, because suddenly people with no rights, with no recognition of their humanity, their value, suddenly realized, hey, this is recognizing me as a person, and they want my opinion. I think that that was the beginning of the rights education process. We haven't yet devised a plan, but we are already talking with the other organizations that are in human rights education. And we will try and make realistic plans. I think that to teach people about rights that seem ephemeral and not very relevant to them is maybe wasting your time. So I think we should actually take it a step at a time. The Education for Democracy, which was a logical place to start, how you vote, how you go about voting, I think that we'll look at almost packages in terms of education in the future. But that's speculation, because we haven't started that yet. We're still recovering from a wonderful election.
All right, one last question. I've heard some talk now that South Africa, with this experience, may be in a position to export human rights now, to help the rest of the world. Is there something for the rest of the world to learn here?
We can certainly teach people about negotiating. The rest's still to come. Yeah, I think one of the most extraordinary things that we have achieved here is a negotiated solution to what was a bloody conflict. And I think maybe that's what the world could learn from South Africa. I've seen in the past 5 years institutions and just people learning how to go into situations of conflict and negotiate to a place where you can have two winners. And I think if the world can learn that lesson from us, that's something pretty special that we can give.
This has been the second in a two-part Common Ground look at creating South Africa. In the weeks to come, we'll examine the role of religion in apartheid and post-apartheid South Africa, and we'll look at the fledgling environmental justice movement there. Please join us. I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9426, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9426. To order by credit card, you can call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.